Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this November 4th. It is election day. It is a Tuesday. It is a it's 9:12 in the morning. A lot going on today, and we're going to talk about all of it, or as much as we can get into in the time we have allotted. We have a great group this morning. We welcome your input, as always. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Just a reminder, election night, and of course we'll have election coverage here in WAMC tonight as well as throughout the day, and goodness, tomorrow we'll have all the results and all the information that you need to figure out exactly what happened when it comes to the voting. So, and other stuff, of course. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. All right, let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started. Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, is with us. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm well. Everything going okay?
Everything is going well. As we were talking before the show, we're babysitting a dog, we're babysitting a dog. It's a little needy.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah.
So my wife has been sleeping on the couch so that I don't get woken up at night by this dog screaming for her
that's
owners.
Very nice for everybody. Yeah, that's a good deal. We welcome Senior Fellow of the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pendicio, is with us. Good morning, Robert. How are you?
I am well, Joseph. And yourself?
I am fine. All is well.
Good, good. I just back from down south. My wife and I and our dog took a hiking trip down to the Great Smoky Mountains. There might have been a little bit less hiking and more just kind of relaxing and eating and drinking and whatnot, but it was nice to feel like I was extending the fall, you know, because you come back here and suddenly it's cold out and it's starting to feel like winter. Down there, it's still the heart of fall.
Ever the newsman, but let me ask you about, given a national park, was it running as expected?
Seamlessly. We actually touched two national parks. We stopped at Shenandoah on the way down.
So beautiful.
And it's beautiful. And there was actually a sign at the gate saying, the government is shut down, but the park is open. So it was actually pretty easy to get in and around.
Yeah.
And down in the Great Smoky Mountains, this was interesting to me. They were paying for it with state funds because there were employees and rangers like, wait a minute, why are you guys here? Aren't you supposed to be furloughed? And they said, well, no, because this is our busy season. You know, this is the peak of fall. You would think that the national parks are busiest in the summer. Kids are off from school. No, in this case, it's the leaf peepers that go down.
Foliage.
So the states and counties stepped up to fund the park to keep them open, to keep, that economic lifeline going in that part of the world. And boy, do they need it, because the less attractive piece of the trip, there's still a lot of storm damage down there. It's very visible. It's been a year since Hurricane, was it Helene? I can't remember the name. But they're still struggling to recover in spots.
Well, I'm glad you had some time off and enjoyed it.
It was great.
Wonderful to have you back.
Nice to be back.
Catherine Tan is with us, Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, located in Poughkeepsie. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. I didn't get to go on a beautiful hike, but the drive here was fine.
Yeah, it was a nice morning. Looks good.
Some of the leaves are
still there.
So pretty.
Still there. I don't know. I remember growing up, it was always about the weather and turnout for elections. I don't know if they cover such things anymore. Do they, Jay? It used to be a big deal.
I don't know. If there was bad weather, I think they would probably cover that in terms of, is it going to
keep people
depress the turnout? But on a nice day, it's like you don't feel pain. You don't feel the absence of pain. You only feel pain.
Well, today's gorgeous, so people have no excuse. Everyone should be out voting.
Wait, are we talking about the pain of Election Day? I mean, well, the pain comes tomorrow.
No, I think we're talking about this show, actually.
The lack of bad weather. Well, I do take a moment. Every time I walk out the door, I take a moment to consider what the day is like. It is just a way of, moving from the house to the outdoors and saying, breathe. Smell what it smells like, look at the outdoors, and if it's rainy, it's like, okay, well, something will grow because of this, or the well won't run dry. It's the Linus, I think. No, Charlie Brown philosophy of weather. Have a convertible and a pond.
Hmm.
And if it's raining, you can say, oh, well, the pond's filling up. And if it's not raining, you can say, oh, well, this is a great day to drive in a convertible.
That's very good. Yeah, I like that.
Oh, well, I wish I had that kind of optimism.
Yeah, yeah, I see the glasses half full myself, which is just deep enough to drown in.
Oh, we'll have you all bitter by the end of the show. Let's see. The big news, sad story, but the story this morning is about Dick Cheney, the former vice president for President George W. Bush, died at 84. It was announced this morning. A former defense secretary, a former congressman, he held the number two job for 8 years, mm-hmm. and was considered, I think is considered, in the obits that are being written as we speak, as one of the most influential vice presidents ever. And his time, of course, and this was brought out in the BBC story at the top of the hour, but his time in the White House as an advisor during an era of terrorism, 9/11, war, economic change, all of that playing a very large role. And he himself played a very mm-hmm. large role in this. And someone whose political career goes back to working with Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
So this is someone who has had been around for a very long time.
I was going to say, I really appreciated what Jonah Goldberg said a few moments ago on the NPR broadcast. Say what you will about him, you know, admire him or the opposite. What Jonah said was that Dick Cheney showed that you could be a fierce partisan and a public policy intellectual at the same time. That's gone missing in our public life.
10-year member of the House of Representatives, the youngest White House chief of staff in history, the defense secretary from 1989 to 1993, a confidant of presidents and lawmakers. He had impeccable credentials and contacts and was a master in the art of getting things done, preferably without fanfare. In many ways, an inscrutable personality, he had no patience for small talk, almost never spoke about himself, rarely gave interviews or held news conferences, although he sometimes went on television to promote administration policies and was often in the news. He certainly preferred the backstage to the spotlight. This from the obituary in the New York Times. A consummate Washington insider, Mr. Cheney was an architect and executor of President Bush's major initiatives, deploying military power to advance the cause of democracy abroad, championing tax cuts and a robust economy at home, and strengthening the powers of a presidency that, as both men saw it, had been unjustifiably restrained by Congress and the courts in the aftermath of the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandal. Fast forward in his later years, of course, known for his relationship to his daughter, and Lynn Cheney, and who also was had many of the same political beliefs and covered that region, and also was a very outspoken critic of the current president and during his first administration and this latest, and his father followed suit. So those were things that it's hard to believe, and even I know this, I knew this, but when you again hear on these stories that are coming out this morning, that Dick Cheney voted for Kamala Harris, you're like, oh, okay. So that tells you a lot about him, but I think it also tells you a lot about American politics.
I always felt that, you know, it's a very conflicted feeling I have this morning. I had often thought during the Iraq War that the connection to Halliburton and the enrichment of Halliburton as a result of the war. And the enrichment, you know, the whole idea of basically privatizing a lot of the aspects of war was Cheney's doing, and that, you know, whether he enriched himself or he enriched his friends as a result of that was beside the point. It was the corporatization of war, the commercialization of war, and that really bothered me about him, and it made me feel very that he was like beyond corrupt in that sense. But in more recent years, I've come to at least respect him for raising a daughter who had the courage that Liz Cheney had, and I sometimes imagine the two of them sitting together.
I said Lynn Cheney, which is
Lynn was
his wife.
Lynn
and not Liz Cheney.
Liz Cheney.
I stand corrected.
I was right.
Oh, you were right.
Wow.
I was wrong. Yeah, I was wrong.
Cool.
No, I knew I was wrong when I said it, and then I couldn't come. But go ahead.
With no basis to it, just imagine the two of them talking about this whole situation. And I thought, well, you know, there's something redeeming about the guy. I think if he had his choice, he and Karl Rove would have had the, as Karl Rove put it, the permanent Republican majority in Washington. But I think ultimately he probably in his own way was as patriotic as they come. So I'm forgiving here.
Catherine?
I mean, towards the end, like you said, he came out in support of Kamala and expressed, critiques against Trump, but it doesn't quite erase a full legacy, no. Right? To your point. But, you know, when someone influential passes, it's sad for some people.
Okay. Robert.
No, I made the point earlier, and I'll stand by it. I miss that style of public servant, somebody who can be both a virulent, not just fierce, but virulent partisan and a serious public policy intellectual. And to Jay's point, a patriot. I know we're going to talk about the elections, but it's rather dispiriting to compare whether you agree or disagree with his politics. And, you know, we can talk about the Iraq War, which is where I kind of broke with that wing of the Republican Party. I don't know that we have people of that stature in our public life anymore. And I miss honorable disagreements over policy as opposed to, I'm struggling to come up with a way to describe it, brand affiliations or some such. We have a long way to go to recapture that sort of seriousness in our politics.
I apologize for this tortured metaphor here, but that I'm about to throw on you all. But I remember when George W. Bush was running for president and people were saying, well, what experience does he have? And he was, he's the kid of the former president, and he was kind of a screw up and had all these problems and different. And all of a sudden, much like Mamdani is seeing now of, well, what experience does he have? What experience does he have? Well, obviously, Dick Cheney had a great deal of experience. Mm-hmm. However, he was brought in to, that George W. Bush saw in him somebody who knew where the buttons and knew where all of the light switches were. He knew the levers of power. He was there. He was, so you have a governor from Texas, all of a sudden, who's got this guy with this institutional knowledge that goes back decades?
Little gray hair and gravitas.
That's right, and I agree with you entirely that is that's a breed that is long gone by.
I'm almost glad at the moment we don't have someone like that in the administration who actually knows what they're doing, as well as Dick Cheney would know probably how to do what he's doing. There are some people. I think Russell Vought has a pretty good idea of what he's doing. There's a few in the administration, but I don't think they have the moral. I would not have. 40-year-old me would not have believed I'm saying this. I don't think they have the moral grounding of of Dick Cheney. He may have been a rabid partisan, but I think he had some moral grounding, I think. I don't know. He did help start us on the longest war in American history.
Yeah. I'll push back a little bit, Jay, on the idea, and I'm not, you know, necessarily disagreeing with you about the privatization of defense and Halliburton and whatnot. But, man, I hope we never get to the point where we assume that any elected official, past or present, is willing to send, you know, America's sons and daughters into war and put them in harm's way so they can make a buck.
I would hate to think that, too, but I did think it at the time.
I just can't go there. Just can't.
It was weird that it was Halliburton, of all things, that ended up with, I think it was a no-bid contract, ended up with one of the biggest contracts.
Understood. Absolutely. I'm not suggesting that he didn't benefit and Halliburton didn't benefit from it. But, man, if we get to the point where we assume that our leaders make decisions on that basis, I think we're lost.
A month before leaving office, Mr. Cheney struck an unapologetic tone in exit interviews defending the use of broad executive powers in waging war and the treatment of terrorism suspects and in domestic wiretapping, insisting that historians would ultimately look favorably on the administration's efforts to keep the nation safe. And that seems to largely have come to pass, although I would argue mostly through comparison.
We are it's interesting to note, as someone did this morning, that Cheney really one of the things he brought to the executive branch was this idea that the executive branch had given up too much of its power to the other branches and favoring a strong executive. Well, what is that thing about be careful what you wish for?
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation this morning. We welcome you, as we always do, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we welcome your letters. I'm looking down at some of the letters that are coming in, and let's just say they're striking a certain tone. I'll leave it at that. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Jay Jognowitz, Robert Pendicio, and Catherine Tan with us this morning, and we welcome you, panel@wamc.org. We've got letters regarding Dick Cheney's passing, and we'll get to those in just a second. I just want to remind you that is our topic today, that the former Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, passed away this morning, or it was announced that he passed away this morning at the age of 84. So let's go, unless the panel has anything else, I will go to letters. Here we go. Hey, Joe, I was stunned to hear you say that Dick Cheney's death was a sad story.
Yeah, you're right. They did set a tone.
He was an evil man, arguably would have been better off without. I'm not saying that you should have used a celebratory adjective, obviously. You simply didn't need to use any adjective at all. I'm old school that, like, death is sad. But,
yeah.
Okay.
Again, good comment.
I think.
I'm with you.
Condolences. Remembrances are sort of our path. There are members of family and throughout the nation of people who are grieving and who are going through those stages with the passing of someone who was on the international and national stage for a long time and close confidants and friends. So I do think for some, obviously. I do equate, and I apologize for this, and I know there are, but I do, I equate the passing, the death of someone as a sad
experience. It's a cultural norm, for pity's sake.
It's
we don't celebrate death.
Reaction. My mother read the obituaries religiously since I was born.
Best part of the
And it was always preceded. She'd be reading Newsday, and she'd be sitting at the kitchen table, and my father would be on his way through the room or something, and, oh, look who died. And it could be, you know, Heimlich Himmler, but it would be.
I think this is something that.
And then she would celebrate the fact.
Yeah, I think this is something that we need to deal with better culturally, because you know, not all deaths are sad. And I teach to everyone. I mean, I hope everyone has at least one person mourning their death at the end. So I teach a class on death and birth, and I do have students, read through obituaries, and we talk about the contents of obituaries. And it's always very positive. You never hear something like, well, you know, Anne was a monster and thank God she's gone, right? You don't ever get anything like that. But I think there's room for us culturally to discuss and negotiate stickier deaths. You know,
a lot of obituaries.
I'm assuming
you're probably reading obituaries from like the New York Times and.
Yeah. I have them go local.
Oh, you do?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah.
So the local ones are no longer written by the paper. Well, unless it's a prominent person.
It's usually a family member submitting.
Yeah. Right. The funeral used to be the funeral parlors sent us, a death notice or sometimes they sent us full editorials. Yeah. But when I started in journalism many, many years ago, one weekend a month, I had to rotate on the Saturday shift and I did all the cop stuff in the morning and it was usually pretty quiet. But you had to do all the obituaries. All the obituaries.
Wow.
And you got on the phone with a funeral director and you asked them questions and they were usually prepared, but once in a while they would be like, I don't want to tell you that. Like how old she was. And my editor reamed me out one day. He said, give me the number. I'll call him. We're creating a public record here. But nowadays that's gone.
Yeah.
At the local level, a lot of it is just paid obituaries, no less.
So I'm assuming you never wrote them in advance, right? The way the big papers do. You did. Okay.
Yeah. Or a few we had on file. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Not a lot.
Because your point about it's untoward, my word, not yours, to excoriate the dead in obituary. I just happened to read one the other day that it was affirming the person who died, but horrible to her mother. It was Marlene Dietrich's daughter who died. And it's funny, I don't normally read obits for whatever reason. I just happened to read it this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And man, Marlene Dietrich came out not good in that obit for her daughter.
We had a few obituaries over the years on notorious people, and we would often get calls after that saying, why would you write such nasty stuff about a person who's dead? It's because this was their life. They should have worried about that while they were alive.
I think that's different. I mean, I go with your, but it is, I mean, you know this better than anybody, Jay, but I mean, people love reading obituaries.
Oh, yeah. They are really well written often.
My father always right. Did your mother do this? Because this was my father. Yeah, I read them every day just to make sure I'm not in there.
<You're right.
laughs> Followed by his Henny Youngman joke of, did you ever notice they all die in alphabetical order?
It's always interesting to see what is highlighted immediately after a person dies, right? How their story is told. And then a more, especially with public figures, and then a more sobering look like, several months later. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out soon.
So here are some examples of if you don't have anything nice to say, here you go. Pete says, I miss the days when Dick Cheney was the worst kind of Republican we could ever imagine. Raymond writes, without the Iraq War, you don't get nearly a million Iraqi dead. ISIS, the Syrian civil war, the Syrian refugee crisis, thousands upon thousands of dead and injured and traumatized U.S. soldiers. Despite his animosity toward Trump, he is a war criminal. Then, Stella, the corporatization of war is the problem one of your panelists had. How about the Iran-Contra cover-up, complicity, lies, torture, assassination, and the death of millions in the Middle East and South Asia that he doggedly advocated for? Can you forgive that?
Yeah, I do want to. We were talking on the break, and I said, I'm not sure "forgive" was quite the right word after more of this jogged my memory about the two that I jotted down were torture, waterboarding, and the other was the massive spying on citizens that began in the Bush administration, and I think Cheney had a lot to do with. So forgiveness is probably a bigger word than I was looking for, but it's the one that rolled off my tongue at the moment, unfortunately.
Please remember that his daughter was only one of only two Republicans that stood for the Constitution when all the others recoiled, and now we find ourselves in this mess. That from Diane. All right. I'm just reading a letter. Moms Mabley used to say, you shouldn't say nothing about the dead. Lesson, you can say something good. He's dead. Good.
Ow.
Ouch.
That's why I read it again, but I do think it's funny.
So spicy group of
yeah, there you go.
Write-ins today.
First time on the show, Catherine.
extra feicy today.
There you go.
Yeah. Don reminds us that Mr. Cheney had a heart transplant at the time. A comedian commented that Dick Cheney has a new heart. I don't know if it was installed or transplanted, but he now at least has a heart. All right. We'll get away from that and move on to other topics as we.
Another letter.
You said spicy, but yeah, it's a hard group this morning. It's let's go to other stories making news and things that are with us on this election day, and that is, of course, that it is election day.
Oh my!
It is election day, and here we are. We're going to find out some stuff, aren't we? here are some of the races that we are following. I was interested. I finally ended up with an NBC piece that I found last night that I thought did a pretty good job in sort of putting all the races together. There's quite a few, of course. New York City mayor, that's a big one. Mm-hmm. We talked about that yesterday. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about it again today. That's a big one. The other one, Virginia governor. Former Democratic Representative Abigail Spanberger and Republican Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earl Sears are vying to become the Commonwealth's first female governor. And that is a race that has seemed to be said to be close. But... the latest polls, I think, showed...
I think it's outside the margin of error.
Is it now?
I haven't looked lately, but last time I looked, Spanberger was up by about 8, I think.
Yeah.
New Jersey is close. New Jersey is solidly within the margin of error.
Democrats have leaned heavily into the rising cost of living and the government shutdown, arguing that Republicans aren't standing up to Trump amid federal worker layoffs and tariffs that they argue are making life harder for Virginians. Earl Sears' campaign has fought back largely by focusing on issues like school policy regarding transgender students, particularly their use of bathrooms and locker rooms. We did talk about that particular issue being used as a campaign issue on our program yesterday. Then we move on to other races that are being watched on this Tuesday. What often is referred to as an off-year election, right? But here we are. Democratic Representative Mikey Sherrill emerged from a crowded Democratic primary to face off against Republican Jack Cetarelli, a former state legislator who cruised to the Republican nomination again after losing the governor's race in 2021 to Democrat Governor Phil Murphy by just 3 percentage points, a close race then, and as you indicated, a close race now. Unlike in Virginia, public polling has long shown a competitive race here where polls close at 8 p.m. Both campaigns have cast the race as a referendum on affordability in the high-tax state, which is also experiencing soaring electricity costs. Trump has endorsed the Republican, and in a Monday night tele-rally, he said the race was the biggest election in the nation and that, quote, the entire country is watching New Jersey. Once again, the entire country is watching New Jersey.
Yeah, that's an election that people are really excited about.
There's California's redistricting ballot measure. California Democrats are asking the state's voters to greenlight a new congressional map drawn by the party that would give it a chance to net up to 5 House seats in next year's midterms, a big piece of the national redistricting battle. Also, a special election in Texas in the 18th congressional district, 8 months after the death of Democratic Representative Sylvester Turner. Voters in the Deep Blue District will select a successor to serve out the rest of Turner's term, which runs through the end of next year. Pennsylvania, there, voters are going. Three Pennsylvania Supreme Court justices face retention elections this year, in which voters will decide whether to keep them in office or render those seats vacant. And then there are a bunch of important state ballot measures that we can get to if we have time. But those are the big ones.
Well, this is the town of Knox, you know.
Yes.
I just want to, because I am skipping half my routine today and going back to vote.
And the issues in Knox?
None. No, actually, they are working. It's an interesting thing. They are working on broadband to reach the 20% of the town that does not have it. And that's one of the issues. I don't know that it's come up in the race very much, but it's about to come up as an issue. It's an interesting thing. It's a whole long story. I won't get into it. Other than that, no, there aren't any real big issues in Knox this year. They're finishing up the new transfer station, and we are – I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. Yeah. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll go through some of these races and talk about the feelings of the panelists on how these are – how important these are and how they may or may not turn out. We will get back to it right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We were talking earlier about the death of former Vice President Dick Cheney and the fact that here was a man so closely associated with the Republican Party, and in his later years, just last year, voted for Kamala Harris, the Democratic candidate, and we were saying, you can't believe that happened given the history. Yesterday, Donald Trump endorsed Andrew Cuomo. Oh my God! Like it's just odd, right? I mean, I know there's a lot of context with the race itself, and I understand the political machinations there, but you just think of the 2020-2021 hellscape of those two going at it, and then suddenly, and it's a backhanded endorsement, certainly, but it is an endorsement from the sitting president of the United States for Andrew Cuomo running for the Democrat.
Well, could you have seen him endorse Sliwa in his little animal camp platform?
Wasn't there talk for a while of Sliwa getting an administrative role under the Trump administration just to make Cuomo?
To get him out of the race.
Am I remembering that correctly?
There probably was talk of it. I don't know. Nothing came of it. Really serious, yeah. Though. Yeah. Sliwa must have been thrilled to hear that yesterday. But maybe somebody gave him a heads up. But still, that's, you're the Republican in the race, and the Republican president who has nothing good to say about Democrats endorses one of the not – I wouldn't call Andrew Cuomo a Democrat.
Because of his, quote, silly little hat.
What? Well, I don't remember this.
Really?
No, Trump's talking about one of the reasons he could not endorse him. He wears that silly little hat.
And not because of the 16 cats.
Okay. Jay?
Cuomo's public relations
has
been just fascinating. He does. And they keep – they're as optimistic as can be. I mean, some of these polls have been 50% or over. And some of them have been, stuck in the let's say 40s, and Cuomo's been in the 30s. Yeah. But they're constantly, we're coming up. We're going to win. And I'm like, you remind me of the night. It's just a flesh wound.
Well, I mean, Mamdani clearly has a ceiling. I mean, I don't think he has polled above 45%, right?
In a couple of polls, at least one poll, I saw he hit 50.
He did. Okay. And that, to me, explains...
But it might have been an outlier.
Yeah, that explains the Trump endorsement. It's not, I'm endorsing Cuomo. I'm trying to stop Mondani.
Yeah.
And I hope the Democratic Party, like, learns something from this election, right? Mamdani's success has been really eye-opening. The Democratic Party, like, did not learn this with Bernie, right? So I hope they get the message this time. But Mamdani's opponents keep pointing to the fact that he lacks experience. But what they fail to recognize is that experienced leadership has failed to deliver, right? People do not want the status quo. New Yorkers, you know, are struggling. It's so expensive to, of course, it's, you know, it's so expensive to live in the city. It's so expensive even to live in, like, Poughkeepsie, right? The cost of living is out of control. And he is really speaking to the heart of what people are worried about, right? You have all these young people who did everything they were supposed to do, and they can't get jobs, and they're struggling, and they're being forced out of, you know, the city. And Cuomo represents the status quo. So, you know, yeah, he's, like, running independent, and, you know, he's gotten the endorsement from Trump, but he represents, like, the status quo. He comes from a long line of politicians. He's been a politician for, you know, for years. And he's really not speaking to what people are worried about and what concerns them. And it's what's fascinating with Mamdani is, you know, this guy emerged seemingly out of nowhere. And in the last year, he has gained so much grassroots support. Mm-hmm. Like, it's incredible. I saw that he has the largest network of volunteers in New York history, mm-hmm. which is so impressive. It really tells you something about what people want. I have a friend, Nicholas Okuto, who's been working on this campaign for the last year, and it has been stunning. I mean, his dedication has been incredible, but it's also stunning to see the amount of support that has come out for Mamdani and what he represents.
Yeah. I think old folks like myself don't. I'm starting to get it that, you know, Cuomo's statement the other day. He said or Rich has a party statement. I'm not sure who said it. That we have to take the party back,
sure.
Or we have to protect the party from the progressive wing. The far left wing. I think he might have even said progressive wing. And this has been Cuomo's. This has been where Cuomo has always been since I've known him, that Richard Brodsky called him a progractionary, I think, a progressive reactionary, if there is such a thing.
I miss Dick Brodsky.
He was great.
He was great. He was great for a quote.
He was hell of a guy to work with.
Yeah, I bet.
I mean, he was much of a prima donna as I was when it came to writing. But,
Republicans were smart to lean into their outlier,
into their
right? And look where it got us. Unfortunately, look where it got us. Mm-hmm. But they listened to their base. They leaned in. Trump won twice. And Democrats, like, they need to wake up to that, right? Yeah. They need to do something similar. Like, Mamdani is speaking to Mamdani exposes, like, the identity crisis that's happening in the party and how there's such misalignment and discordance between the longtime, you know, leaders of the party and the young voters.
And that fight's been brewing since since Bill de Blasio was mayor, mm-hmm. and he and Cuomo. And, you know, I thought it really took nerve for Cuomo to say that Mamdani was going to be another failure. He was Bill de Blasio light. And this is the governor who helped make Bill de Blasio a failure.
Yes, absolutely.
I have a bit of a dog in this fight insofar as I lived in New York City for 30 years. I made my joke with it. I didn't want to live there for 30 minutes, but I married a Manhattanite and there we were. But I'm also, I mean, Jay, you're not the only gray hair here. I'm old enough to have remembered New York City in the bad old days. Mm-hmm. You know, I've joked for years, like, if you missed the gritty old New York, that means you didn't live
there.
Right? So, I mean, one of the reasons I was able to live in New York for 30 years, raise my daughter there, is because it became a very livable city, a pleasant place to be. And I'm not a city guy. If people are concerned with Mamdani's youth and inexperience, I don't think that's misplaced. I mean, he doesn't have much of a resume. The politics of this is, are interesting to me, but you got to be able to deliver on this, yes, right? And, you know, okay, sure, he's not my flavor, as it were. But if you're talking about freezing the rent, well, we know how that movie ends. That movie ends with slumlords, right? Because then if you can't make a buck on your housing, you don't take care of it, you know?
Oh, they're already not taking care of it.
But I mean, those of us who are old enough to remember New York in the bad old days, look at this guy with a little bit of, you know, trepidation, you know, that free buses, in other words, free mobile homeless shelters, for example. Mm. There's a lot that can go wrong here. The thing that people miss about the New York City mayor's office is it's not a political stepping stone. I completely get the appeal to a young, energetic character. He's a fantastic politician, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But the mayor's office in New York is maybe the highest profile operational job in politics. You know, so the Republicans might not beat him, but you know what, Will? A snowstorm. Like, which is what undid de Blasio, right? Remember that a few weeks into his first term, there was a big snowstorm and it was chaos in New York. Whether you're progressive or conservative or in the middle, New Yorkers expect the trains to run on time. They expect the snow to get plowed. They expect the trash to get picked up.
But not to turn this on, but de Blasio, by many, we could say a lot about the guy, but going in was thought of as a seasoned and experienced politician, as was Eric Adams.
Politician, but not necessarily. I mean, this is Cuomo's, and I'm not. You know, I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm registered to vote up here. Cuomo has a little bit of the Bloomberg thing about him, right? In other mm-hmm. words, he has more of an more operational chops, as it were. That's his calling.
But to Catherine's point, that ain't working.
People are tired of the devil they know.
Right, until the snow doesn't get plowed.
Well, who's to say? You know, I think we should give the kid a chance because I hope so. I mean, I don't live in the city anymore. I don't vote in the city anymore. I'm a Poughkeepsie lady now, but I think he.
You seem a little bitter about that. But go ahead.
It's just as expensive, and it's not New York.
Well, yeah, but I think it's unfair for us to assume. Mm-hmm. Before he even has a shot, that he's going to do a bad job.
Because I'm not assuming.
The hypothetical snowstorm. But I think that this is a really monumental moment, right? So win or lose, he represents a turn in the Democratic Party, right? And this is something that people should pay attention to.
This is why a lot of Republicans, Republicans want him to win. They want him to be the face of the party. To Jay's point about, you know, and both the right and the left have it, let's be clear. You know, you've got the Groypers on the right, you've got the uber progressives on the left. You know, both parties are trying to right size their relationship with their fringe, as it were. But I think a lot of Republicans are hoping that he wins.
I'm glad we're on the same page for
you're confusing me with the Republican, Catherine.
No. I mean, like, so the Republicans, they think he's going to win. And what's going to happen is everything is going to fall apart. And they're going to say, well, he's trying to turn New York into Cuba. But really, the man is just trying to turn New York into, like, France or Sweden, where people get to live longer. And it would be nice if we had some of the same nice things.
We will we'll pause there because we have to take a break. And David Gesina is ready to do the news, and I don't want to keep him longer than he has to in the studio. So we'll let him do his thing. We'll come back and we can continue where we left off right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. 10 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Tuesday morning, the 4th of November. It is Election Day, and we remind you of that. And we are talking about elections. We're talking about races really around the country. Most recently, we've been talking about the New York mayoral race. Is there, first of all, is there anybody, does anybody want to say anything else about that before we move on to some of the other races?
Yeah, just one last thing. I don't know who it was that said you campaign in poetry and you
govern in prose.
Great line. But I think that is the heart of, you know, where this discussion ends up on whether Mondami succeeds or not. That, you know, up until now we've heard his ideas. It'll be a question, I think, of who he surrounds himself with, assuming he wins. And does he surround himself with ideologues, inexperienced ideologues, or does he surround himself with ideologues who have experience, who believe what he's talking about, and have a plan for accomplishing what he set out to do?
We were saying during the break, I mean, I work in education policy, and I'm a former New York City public school teacher. I taught in Mott Haven, the South Bronx, for many years. My biggest concern, it's parochial, but I think it's important, is Mamdani's education plan. And I have not heard him articulate one to my satisfaction. Mm-hmm. The reason my education career went from what was supposed to be a two-year mid-career public service stint to 25 years and counting on curriculum and instruction is because of the poor state of literacy instruction in New York City. It took 25 years to get rid of a, frankly, terrible non-program, the so-called Teachers College Readers and Writers program, that somebody once described as vibes-based literacy, which was, I wish I'd come up with that phrase, that they put in place under his predecessor, I'm assuming his predecessor, Adams, current Mayor Adams, a program called New York's NYC Reads. And it's a pretty good structured literacy program. And I haven't heard him say a word about it.
Did Cuomo say?
I believe he's made noises in support of it, honestly.
I think when you're running a campaign, though, you know, there are talking points or issues that you have to stick
granular.
To, you know. And if you're going all over the place, people don't know what you stand for.
Yeah.
And what he stands for, Mamdani, the things that he is pushing, it's affordable housing, it's the free bus, it is free daycare. And these are, you know, he is speaking directly to people's financial strain. So I hope, you know, to your point, I hope he does come out and offer, you know, educational support. I think that I'm with you. I'm not as familiar, and he hasn't articulated his plan for education as clearly as he has for other issues.
Yeah.
But it's a political campaign.
Yeah,
like, you have to stick close to the prime issues.
I would hope that somebody like Mondami recognizes, and I think he does, that education could be the equalizer.
If I'm not mistaken, it's the biggest single item in the New York City budget, right? Yeah. And after 25 years of kind of banging our heads against the wall to get that literacy program change and getting something that it's early, but it seems to be bearing fruit, but it's not going to bear fruit if you don't stick with it.
And
this is the unlovely part of governing. This is the prose part, Jay.
But
right?
I think this highlights what's going on in people's lives. Like, if we're campaigning and doing well on affordability, it tells you what an awful position Americans are in right now economically, right?
Yeah.
We are dealing with basic needs about getting food, paying for transportation, affording the house, you know, the roof over your head.
Yeah.
It really says a lot about where we are as a country, where New York is as a city. But it's, you know, this issue, you know, his campaign highlights the problem that is consuming most people in this country right now.
Right. Okay. So I completely get his appeal to younger voters. But what happens, I'm riding my education schooling hobby horse here, what happens when those young voters have children and the schools are in bad shape? Then what?
Well, people are not having...
Then Texas.
A lot of people are choosing not to have kids because they can't afford the daycare, right? Yeah. It's in the city. I have a lot of friends, but very few of them have kids. You know, daycare is something like at minimum $3,000 a month. And this is like daycare out of someone's house, right? We call it bodega daycare, but this is daycare out of someone's house. And it's minimum is like $3,000, right? So how can anyone afford that? I mean, I'm a professor with a PhD. I have a good job, and I can tell you right now, I cannot afford that. That is not happening, right?
Wow.
So these are the issues that people feel desperate about. Like, we aren't, like, yes, education is, of course, it's incredibly important. But we are talking about food on the table, roof over the head, you know, roof over our heads, and paying for daycare. Like, these are the people aren't even there. They wish they can cook. They wish they can worry about education. But there are so many other issues before we get there, which is not to say it's not important. It's incredibly important.
He's going to win. There's no doubt in my mind.
I hope so.
He's
don't
win.
Jinx it.
And I wish him well.
First of all, I just, my wife and I so enjoy, we don't have children. We so enjoy spending the money that we would spend on childcare and education. It's kind of nice.
Oh, yeah. I'm a pretty happy dink.
Yeah, right.
No kids.
Yeah. That's right. It's nice. The other thing, too, though, and let me just bring this back to the Democratic Party for a moment, and because, Catherine, I think you make a really interesting point. To me, it's inexplicable, and I don't say this as any. I'm not endorsing anyone. I don't think anybody. This is just like common sense for me. But I do not understand where you have an establishment Democrat like Chuck Schumer, who refuses to endorse the winner of the primary in the city of New York, the city that you're from. It doesn't make any sense to me. He's certainly not the only one who hasn't done it. If you're going to complain about bringing new people into the party, if you're going to complain about, here was a guy that beat 12 other people in a primary, 12 other people.
Right.
The people spoke. And then this is what they said. So, and we'll see, obviously, they'll speak again today. But how do you not then endorse it and say, well, you know, we don't want to
be...
Well,
this is a problem with the party, right? This is a problem that has been going on for a while.
How can you think that is not going to come back and bite you? I mean, I just don't get it.
Hold on. I mean, not my party, but am I mistaken to say that he's concerned about being primaried by AOC, so therefore you don't align yourself? Isn't that the calculus here?
I don't know. If he were the only one, I think perhaps that would be a calculus. But given that some of there were a lot of people that it took a long time to get them to endorse.
Including
the governor. In a backhanded endorsement.
Sure.
And so I don't know.
I think it's a problem when the Democratic Party or leaders of the Democratic Party are seeing an endorsement for Mamdani as some sort of radical move. I don't think his positions are all that radical, right? Like, consider, you know, FDR, New Deal stuff. Like, what he's calling for is greater support for the people who are most vulnerable, most in need. It is increasing the city tax for the richest people, right? So, in order to support social programming and social safety nets, like, these are the things that we need. If we're concerned about homeless people riding on the bus for free, well, you know, if we had better support for mental health and we had better support for affordable housing, then we wouldn't have those problems.
So, and maybe I'm going to get in trouble, but let me just further this just a little bit. But I was watching a local. It's a very small town in upstate New York that had has an election. I'm watching a candidates forum, and one of the people in the audience asks this village council candidate whether they supported a woman's right to choose. And
why is that an issue in a local?
Okay. All right. Exactly. Okay.
But this is where our politics has left the rails. Okay. We nationalize everything.
But exactly. So then you have the regionalization and people saying, well, I mean, are his politics what America needs? We're not talking about the politics of what America needs. He's being voted on in the city of New York. Mm-hmm. It's much different. And I don't understand why people can't see that there is a regionalism to this as well, and that somehow when the great book is written and you Dick Cheney it one day, that at some point people are going to come back and say, endorsement on me.
You know what happened, there's a lot of people that don't want the idea of a person with the adjective socialist attached to their political resume to win and succeed.
Yeah.
Agreed.
What if he succeeds? My God, what would that say
about
capitalism?
What do you
mean
by succeed?
Is
succeed he wins or succeed
no,
he
succeed
gets to
in
create
actually,
this?
Actually doing,
okay.
doing the job.
Substantially what he set out to do.
Yeah.
That's a real threat to the old establishment. And I think that Schumer not endorsing him, I have nothing to base this on, but we're talking about one of the biggest money machines in Congress, I'm sure did not want to upset his donors, the donor class in New York City. The donor class in New York City, I think, is beside themselves about this.
Yeah.
I think people are way too caught up in the label of socialist, mm-hmm. right? Mamdani is actually not a classic socialist, mm-hmm. right?
Classic socialism has never really been tried.
He's not,
right?
but he's been well branded with it.
Yeah, and people are using it to dismiss him, to disparage him before they even mm-hmm. understand what he is. What he represents and what he is pushing for.
Joe, I want to go back to the point that you just made about, you know, the endorsement. Again, I assume a lot of this has to do with internecine Democratic Party politics and which direction the party is going.
Yeah.
But we've now reached the point, this is maybe an obvious point, it's the opposite of Tip O'Neill's famous thing about all politics is local. Now all local politics is national.
No, that's a great point. It's a great, great point. I just I find myself little veins in my head exploding when it's from doing the show of people saying, this so and so is too old, so and so is too old. Even Obama coming out and saying anybody, you know, the 80% of our problems are caused by people in their 80s who are doing this work. Okay, so now you have a young guy who is stepping up, who has the support of the people of the city, at least in the primary. We will see in the general election later today. You know, you can't have it both ways, right?
Yeah.
All right, I'll stop. anybody want to say anything about Virginia or New Jersey?
If I were a betting man, and I'm not, and I had to bet on a Republican upset, New Jersey is probably where I would place my chips. I don't think it's going to happen in Virginia. I don't think it's going to happen in New York City. I mean, obviously Sleeve was not going to win in New York City, but I do not expect to wake up tomorrow morning and find out that Cuomo has, you know, snatched victory from the jaws of defeat. But it would not surprise me if Mikey Sherrill does not win. I'm not predicting it, but I'm just saying it would not shock me. It would not be a stunning upset.
I would be surprised if Virginia. Well, there's more at stake in Virginia too. There's a the legislature, I think, the House in Virginia is also up for grabs, and this is where I think, you know, all politics is local, all politics is national. That whole discussion comes to bear because this is a state that's right on the doorstep of Washington.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in Virginia are without jobs right now. And a lot of people know people who are jobless. Yeah. And it will be interesting to see if people vote their interest or vote their party.
Yeah. The one thing I hope we don't do, and it's funny because I was fully prepared for this conversation to go in this direction this morning. I just hope we resist the temptation to, you know, turn this into an exercise in tea leaf reading for the midterms. I mean, I do think we tend to overanalyze off-year elections, and, you know, the midterms are a year away.
That's stupid.
Thank you. I mean, I completely agree.
That
will be the story tomorrow.
That will be the story tomorrow.
Much can happen between now and then,
yes,
right? I don't think there's any sense in looking at this current election and then projecting it that far in advance.
Yeah, no, but
things change so quickly these days.
Absolutely, but I wouldn't want to bet my rent money on any outcome today, but I would bet my rent money that will be the news cycle tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that'll be the talking.
It's already
that'll
the
be
news
the people
cycle.
Around a table right. talking tonight yeah. on CNN and NBC.
I mean, the first thing I saw this morning was, you know, by the end of today, we will have a better reading on how the Trump administration is going.
No, he won't.
We won't have any reading at all. We'll know how the people of Virginia, we'll know how the people of New Jersey, we'll know how the people of New York City voted and what they wanted for their particular states mm-hmm. and municipalities.
Well said. Hear, hear, Jim. Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's move on to other stuff, and we're going to take a break in about 5 minutes. So we'll maybe start this and then go on. Let's see. First of all, just a couple letters because we got the one just that came in. There's no mystery why Schumer has not endorsed Mandami. It's Mandami's position on Israel and Gaza, and that's a good point. And good to make that. And also the idea that Mamdani fails if he can't convince the power structure in New York to make New York City into Copenhagen is silly. He'll shoot for the stars and will succeed in making more modest improvements. We won't know how much of Mamdani's goals will be accomplished until he has had the chance. But he is the smartest, most compassionate, most creative candidate in recent history. Whatever he does will be better than the guy who was driven from the governor's office and is willing to sound like a Republican to get elected mayor. Mm-hmm. Denise says, I see Mamdani as another Obama. During Obama's mm-hmm. first presidential run, I remember all the skepticism and fear about the fact that he had little political experience and that he had been a community organizer. What the heck was that? I hope to see Mamdani have the same type of no-drama Obama political career in New York and beyond. I'm so sick of all the drama at the presidential level. Let's hope he wins and can really turn things around. And this from Vincent. One needs to be exceptionally highly skilled pragmatist to successfully run a municipality, let alone one of the largest cities in the world. Mm-hmm. There is no doubt that Mamdani nails it ideologically, but that's not enough. Even with brilliant people surrounding him, top-notch leadership skills still win the day. Love him or hate him, I still think that Bloomberg was the best New York City mayor. The best mayor that New York City has seen, a guy who built a hugely successful company from the ground, not to mention his extraordinary public health work. I hope Mamdani succeeds for all of our sake. That from Vincent.
Good letter.
All right. Now, let's go to setting up the next story, and we'll bring it in after the break. The other big story yesterday, it was in the regards to SNAP benefits, and we talked a lot about this last week and even yesterday on the program because of the court acting over the weekend and what was the president going to do. The Trump administration said Monday that it will release enough funds to pay for a half month's worth of food assistance benefits in November, days after two courts ordered the U.S. Department of Agriculture to release the money to avoid forcing almost 42 million Americans into food insecurity. This from the Washington Post. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, or what we knew of as food stamps, mm-hmm. lost funding after the Trump administration said it would not tap into a $5.5 billion contingency fund to pay for the benefits. On Friday, a federal judge in Rhode Island ordered the administration to release backup funds moments after another federal judge in Massachusetts directed the government to decide by Monday whether it would use the contingency funds for food aid. USDA said Monday that it will comply with the Rhode Island judge's order. The department's lawyers, in a Monday brief, wrote that the agency, quote, will fulfill its obligation to expend the full amount of SNAP contingency funds today. The White House deferred comment to the Office of Management and Budget, which, along with the USDA, did not respond for a request for comment. SNAP regularly costs the federal government about $9 million a month, but the federal shutdown.
$9 billion
a month, yes. $9 billion a month, thank you. But the federal shutdown, which has lasted more than a month, has affected the program because Congress has not appropriated new funds. The available money in the contingency funding will pay for only about half of November's benefits.
You know, it's an interesting thing that the administration figured out a way by Monday morning how to pay for SNAP when it said last, when the president was saying last week, well, we need the court to tell us if it's okay for us to do this. Yeah. I mean, they are finding every which way, or they're going to try to find every which way to stall. Do you need a break?
I need a break. I'm going to pause you there.
Okay.
And we'll come right back to it, I promise.
We'll finish up the road.
Oh, you can get warmed up again. Don't you worry about that. We'll be back just in about 2.5 minutes or so right after this. Well, if you missed right before the break, I got Jay all worked up talking about the Trump administration saying it's paying out half of November's SNAP benefits. And when I say worked up, he was just ready to go. And then, boom, I had to pull the plug because we had to go to a break. So do I need to say all the trigger words to get you going again, or are you ready
no,
to
I'm
go?
Good. I'm
all
good.
Right, go.
So this is an administration that's been playing, you know, kind of batting its eyes, footsie kind of stuff with SNAP. First, they didn't have the money, and then it was illegal. Like, this president worries about what's illegal when it comes to shifting money around. Right. And then it was like, oh, well, if the court said we have to do this, we still have to go back to the court and ask them, which I think was their attempt to lure the judge into a judicial trap where they would get the judge to give them explicit directions on how to spend money, and then the Supreme Court would eventually rule that's not the judiciary's job. But I think this judge knew it and probably signaled to them, I'm not going to tell you how to do your job. I'm just telling you to do your job. And there's plenty of other money out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a president. I've said this, several times in the last few days. This is a president who somehow has found money to have a war with fishermen and possibly with Venezuela and maybe with Nigeria. This is a president who figured out how to build a ballroom, to redo a bathroom.
And so out of touch.
Yeah.
Announcing that in the middle of this crisis.
Of this crisis.
It's
well, this
incredible.
Is his way of
and this
trolling.
Is a deliberate decision, too. Like you said, the funds are there. There are billions of dollars in reserve that he could tap, and he's choosing not to. And withholding food from the poor as leverage to cut health care is some diabolical nonsense, right? One in eight families rely on the support of SNAP, and it's mostly households with children, the elderly, disabled people, right? It's the most vulnerable, it's our most vulnerable populations. And, you know, these are not the imaginary able-bodied free riders that Republicans are always trying to portray, you know, when they're trying to close and cut funding to welfare programs. It's horrible. And, you know, SNAP, it's actually not that much money when you look at how much is distributed to people, right? It is, on average, I think $188 per month per person, which comes out to about $6 a day. What can you get for $6 a day anymore? You can't get anything, you know, like even fast food has gotten expensive. And these are people who rely on these benefits. I was looking it up, and from the Department of Agriculture, the stats was that for people receiving SNAP, SNAP households spend 75% of their benefits by the middle of the month. By the time they reach the end of the month, they've already spent 95.9%, which tells you a lot. People rely on these benefits, right? They can't wait for it to be delayed. If you've spent all of it by the end of the month, this is already hurting so many people because, you know, November 1st came and went. People still don't have the money dispersed. We don't know when it's going to happen. So they say there's going to be a partial disbursement, but who knows when that will be. And already families are hurt. And it's terrible that this is what is being leveraged in the middle of the shutdown.
I think they thought the optics would be it would be so bad the Democrats would have to cave and do the continuing resolution.
Who does it? Yeah, but like who looks bad here, right?
Yeah.
Who looks bad? Most Americans are blaming this on Trump.
Yeah.
I think they both look bad, to be honest. I mean, and this is becoming a little bit of a cynical exercise. Back to the shutdown. So on SNAP, the Republicans have exaggerated the number of non-citizens on the program. I think that's for starters. But I cannot shake the feeling, frankly, that the Democrats seem to have been waiting for this shift because, you know, the polling has seemed to show up until now that more Americans blame the Democrats than the Republicans for the shutdown. So the Democrats have rejected, 13 chances to pass a clean CR? And again, I hope this isn't so, but it feels like they're betting that food insecurity is the issue that changes the dynamics of the shutdown, the politics of the shutdown in their favor. So the entire standoff feels cynical to me. Feeding the hungry is a non-negotiable. Look, the other piece of this story that is alarming and I think should alarm us as Americans was what you were saying, Catherine. 1 in 8 families is on on SNAP. That's a huge number.
Huge.
And it's quite disturbing. But look, weaponizing hunger is disgraceful.
Yeah.
And I don't think that any one party bears the responsibility. I think both parties are equally culpable here.
But Democrats, what choice do they have?
Pass the CR. That's the choice.
But they lose the health care. I mean, January 1st is going to come around, and people are really going to feel it, right? Like, the cost of insurance is going to skyrocket. People are not going to be able to afford coverage, so they don't really have much of a choice. It's like, okay, we can say, well, let's just pass it so that this shutdown can end. But some pretty big pieces are on the table here.
And there's no provision. The Republicans in the One Big Beautiful Bill made no provision to do anything about what they were taking away in Obamacare. They basically did repeal and replace without the replacement. Hmm. This is effectively destroying Obamacare. And and they tried for years to do it. And every time the Democrats called them on their bluff and said, where's the beef? There was no beef, and the Republicans never had it, and they took all these symbolic votes, and I think it was the Senate just refused to do it because they knew there wasn't anything to replace it. And now we're a different political dynamic in Congress, and the Democrats sense an opportunity that they're not going to get. They're not going to get another opportunity to negotiate anything until possibly 2026.
But what's being negotiated is just so wild to me. It's like, well, do you feed the poor or do you cut their health care?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
These are terrible choices. And yeah, we're a rich country, right? It's insane that we're in this game pretending like we have to choose.
Mm-hmm. Well, but Elon Musk gets a $1 trillion pay package, so
yeah,
we can all
yeah,
take comfort in that, which would probably pay for. I was trying to calculate how many months of SNAP benefits. Elon Musk could probably fund SNAP for a year and not even bat an eye.
You know, private funders are stepping up to help construct this new wing to help fund the troops during the shutdown. Right. Who's going to step up to give some money to SNAP?
So where do you think this is all going as far as if even with half the money?
To hell, Joe. That's where it's all going.
Well, that's sort of what it feels like. I ask the question because we sort of have now, we're figuring out this month because we've had over a month of a shutdown. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't see this. I don't see this ending anytime soon, and I think we're going to be right back here. If not next week, in 2 or 3 weeks, talking about this exact same issue again for next month.
How long has it been going on now, the shutdown?
43 days.
About 6 weeks.
Okay.
I mean, this feels to me like the issue that one way or another will bring an end to it. But I could be wrong.
I get the feeling that there's going to be some very bad blood on Trump's part, that he's going to stew, he's going to throw ketchup at the wall, and he's going to say, you know what, let's run these benefits out, and then we'll make the Democrats, because we'll just say there is no more money, which they're already starting to argue that the WIC money, not WIC, well, one of them, one of the other programs has billions of dollars in it that they could spend. And what the Democrats are saying is spend that money because it's for food benefits. It's related to this. Spend that money. And then we'll worry about refunding that program after we get a budget.
But you could make the same argument about passing a clean CR, right? In other words, this doesn't take it off the table forever. If you're earnestly concerned about health care.
It does. It does take it off the table. It takes it off the table for at least a year.
Okay, but that's not forever.
That's a long time.
Okay.
It's a long time for people to spend, thousands and thousands of dollars extra a month because they've lost they've lost the subsidies on healthcare.
Right. I mean, I've said this before on the roundtable. I'm not a cynical man, but this does feel to me like a rather cynical exercise on both parties' part.
It's a sad exercise, sadder than what we opened the show with.
Yeah. Well, and it's just because it is right. And I mean, you said it just a few minutes ago of how many people this is. This is a lot of people we're talking about. And so I just, as I said a moment ago, I'm just wondering where we're going to be in a month from now as we have either Thanksgiving right before us or mm-hmm. Just past of where we're going to be in the funding and not to mention all the other issues that the shutdown impacts.
It's about 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'll come to a head again. Yeah, unless they can figure something out. But I don't think Trump's going to want to figure something out. I think he's going to want to rub the Democrats' nose in. Fine. You made me spend the money I didn't want to spend. Now I'm going to make you squirm.
All right. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we'll be right back right after this. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, and we appreciate it. We hope that you can – last call for letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Tylenol has been acquired. Kimberly Clark bets that Tylenol can weather the storm. This from the New York Times. The consumer products giant reached a $40 billion deal to buy Kenvue. It's V-U-E. I assume it's Kenvue. The maker of Tylenol, despite a barrage of unproven claims from President Trump and others that use of the pain reliever during pregnancy can cause autism. Much to be made about this, of course. Tylenol is not the sole seller of acetaminophen. However, it was the name that was branded on this from the president in the Oval Office. So in deciding to buy the company behind Tylenol, the consumer products giant Kimberly Clark is betting that the product can withstand an extraordinary attack from President Trump and his administration. Top officials have singled out Tylenol, making unproven claims that the use of acetaminophen during pregnancy can cause autism. The Trump administration's allegations have helped prompt Texas to sue Kenvue, the maker of Tylenol, last week, the first such lawsuit by a state. They could potentially breathe new life into lawsuits filed by hundreds of plaintiffs in state and federal courts and families who claim their children developed neurodevelopmental disorders, including autism and ADHD, after acetaminophen use during pregnancy.
I'm old enough to remember the original Tylenol problem. Remember from 40 years ago where, was it something in Chicago, I think it was? And 9 or 10 people died. I mean,
In capsules.
That's right. That's right. The reason we have child safety caps and all those things to this day was because of that 40 years ago.
McNeil Labs at that point.
Yeah. So the idea that this is a storm to be weathered, sure, but that was an even worse one. My assumption, I used to work at Business Week back in the day, and so I'm trying to remember what that felt like. This feels to me like a simple business story. This is a depressed asset because of what's going on with the allegations of autism. And Kimberly Clark is doing what big companies do. They're seizing a buying opportunity.
Yeah, their valuation took like a 30%
hit. It did, right? Yeah.
Big so there, it's, you know, it was on, the company was on sale.
Yeah.
And they're taking advantage
at fire
of that.
Sale prices.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, and as you mentioned, Joe, the company has a pretty large portfolio. Tylenol makes up just, you know, one thing. But I think it also speaks to how there's no evidence that Tylenol causes neurodevelopmental disabilities, right? And the science is there's more evidence showing that it does not cause neurodevelopmental disabilities, then there is contesting that.
Yeah, but that's what makes it a good buying opportunity.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So they're like, well, there's no evidence. So when this goes to court, like with the Texas lawsuit, like what do they have? Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So it's not, if you're on the side of science, this is not a risky
bet. That said, if you'd asked me yesterday, you know, at point of a gun, who owns Tylenol, I could not have told you.
No, I agree with you.
I would have said Johnson & Johnson.
I thought it was still Johnson
which
& Johnson.
Heard of well,
but
which
they
it was
sold in
sort of,
2023.
Right?
Yeah. News to me.
And I go back, and I believe it was Seth Myers who said, and the brand, this is as the autism claims were going on, said Tylenol forever now known as Plaintiff A. Yeah. So, I mean, they'll get in on the suit, right? I mean, mm-hmm. this company obviously has to look at what damage has been done to the brand.
They're buying the liability as well as the opportunity.
Correct. Right. Yeah. All right. Anybody else on that?
No, just I was surprised at what else they bought with this, and it was like, wow, Band-Aid, mm-hmm. Johnson's Baby Shampoo, Listerine, Neutrogena. I mean, you know, this was not, if you were getting this at a fire sale.
They bought America's medicine cabinet, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have $40 billion on me.
Yeah.
because go. I think this would have been a great deal.
Yeah. And... Right, and
I only needed 10%.
I was listening to the news report last night, and they were trying to explain it. It was somewhat clumsily, which I'm sure is exactly how I'll explain it too. But it's the when they use prestige brands, it's when a brand is what you call the actual product. So a Band-Aid. Mm-hmm. Do people say adhesive bandages? No, they
Kleenex
say it's a Band-Aid.
Right.
Kleenex, and Q-tips,
Tylenol.
And yes, Tylenol. So, right. Here we are, scotch tape, ..
Yeah.
So
that's right.
Off we go. All right. We have a few minutes. Let's go to one story. Hey, Laura Loomer is now credentialed to cover the Pentagon. Why don't you know that? The Washington Post reporting the far-right activist and former congressional candidate has repeatedly criticized defense officials on her website and social media accounts while boasting of her close ties to President Trump. Well, now she is credentialed. This, as I said, from the Washington Post, Laura Loomer, the far-right political activist and former congressional candidate in Florida, has been credentialed to cover the Defense Department, according to one person familiar with the matter, joining a new cohort of right-wing media that have agreed to the Pentagon's new press policies. Loomer is 32 years old, has forged a close alliance with President Trump, routinely meeting with the president in the Oval Office during his second term. She has frustrated some in the administration with her proximity to Trump and public criticisms of high-ranking defense and national security officials who she argues are disloyal to Trump, some of whom have been dismissed soon after her rebukes. Loomer's addition to the Pentagon's press corps comes as the department has overhauled its media policies. Journalists covering the Pentagon walked out of the building en masse last month in response to a new department press policy that prohibited them from soliciting any information not made available by the government. Dozens of news outlets, including the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, Fox News, refused to sign the policy that many called a threat to press freedom. Out of the outlets that made up the day-to-day Pentagon press corps, only One America News, a right-wing cable network, agreed to sign. The Pentagon unveiled the new press corps last month, consisting largely of far-right media publications, including Gateway Pundit, The Post, Millennial, and get ready for it, Wendell TV.
The proof is right around the corner. We're releasing it in 2 weeks that the election was forged. That was Mike Lindell. Was rigged.
The MyPillow guy.
Mike Lindell.
I'm a former ink-stained wretch here. So I mean, this is a multifaceted. If you want to take this story seriously,
ink-stained wretch is I think what I want to put in the subject line of this this segment when we put it up online.
There you go. The idea that Laura Loomer has a press pass is at once cartoonish. I don't think it's particularly serious. We talked about this last time, Joe, when this first happened. You know, you don't get scoops covering the Pentagon sitting in the briefing room. Mm-hmm. And Jay, I think you'll agree with me on this. Yep. You know, you go by developing sources, pounding the pavement, going through public records. Yep. So it's not like this is some kind of gigantic threat to the freedom of the press. I don't know that it's going to be journalistically significant. But what's interesting to me here, and this is more of a threat to journalistic standards, is who is and is not a journalist. In other words, so on the one hand, look, I work for a big think tank, and I'm probably more of a journalist now than I was when I was actually carrying a press pass. I write a lot about education. What I do feels journalistic. Mm-hmm. That's the bigger threat, is where do Americans get their media from? Mm-hmm. Who's considered credible? Who's not? That's almost a beside the point with this story. Mm-hmm. But if I'm running a major media organization, I'm thinking about that right now. Not, oh, gee whiz, my press pass has been revoked.
Yeah. I lost my train of thought. Okay.
But during the break, we were talking about how some pretty random people have been given access, right?
It's not the access they've been given. They've been given the ears of Americans. In other words, mm-hmm. our discernment about who mm-hmm. is and is not a journalist, who is and is mm-hmm. not credible. And it's not always binary. Just because I don't work for the New York Times, therefore I'm not going to mm-hmm. take you seriously. There are serious people out there who are doing quasi-journalistic work. But man, those lines get blurry.
When I heard this story last night, I thought to myself, well, who cares? She's walking in and sitting down in the Oval Office whenever she wants. We're worried about her going to a press briefing at the Pentagon. I think then she should get a press pass? Yeah. I don't know. I just don't see what difference it makes if you've got the access.
Where did she even come from? It's just she emerged one day.
Well, that's a larger question that I think we'll have to put science
percolating
on.
Percolating through that swamp.
I saw a light go on, Jay.
So, yeah, the point I was going to make was I agree with you mostly on the idea that you're not going to get your stories sitting in news conferences and stuff. But there is an advantage. If I had been kicked out of City Hall when I was a City Hall reporter, mm-hmm. I would have had a hard time reporting on City Hall because my sources were in that building, and or a lot of my good sources were in that building. And to be able to just walk into someone's office mm-hmm. and confront them, and it's a weird dynamic that I learned early on that if you sit down in someone's office, they start talking to you, even if they really don't want to. And so I haven't covered the Pentagon. I haven't been in the building. I don't know what the atmosphere is like, but it does help.
Sure,
it does, and I think it hurts. But my hat goes off to all the reporters that did, all the news organizations that walked out and said, no, we are not going to do this policy. But the idea, and I think you hit the nail on the head, it's the perception that this is journalism. No, this is Laura Loomer is not journalism.
Yeah.
And
but that's easy for you and I to say as people who've had careers with big institutions. My point is, I don't think we can afford that arrogance anymore. Because whether or not we think she's serious, that doesn't mean that she's not taken seriously by people, in the broader world.
Well, she can destroy a lot of careers in that building, and I think people will. She'll be reporting stuff in violation of that policy within 2 weeks.
We are out of time. My thanks to this whole group who has been wonderful. Thank you for being here. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you all soon. We'll continue our conversations here on the program right after this short break.